Hello and welcome to Volume 43, Number 38 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 22nd of September 2023. And in the news this week, a sad find from the sea could solve a two-year-old mystery. The town's new RNLI lifeboat is arriving. Our first female taxi driver celebrates hitting the ton. And has someone at GBC dropped a huge clanger? Hi, I'm Graham, your presenter, and I'm joined by Andy, your newsreader for the week, plus Andrew in conversation with local historian David Tubby. As usual, all the details on your local news and events, but first, it's birthday time. And this week, it's listener Stephen Miller celebrating on the 29th, next Friday. So all our best wishes go out to you, Stephen. Have an excellent day. It's news time, so over to Andy.
Hello, and I'm going to start this week's news, as I usually do, with various stories of crime and disorder. And the first one relates to drugs. An Albanian national, already convicted of producing Class B drugs, has been jailed after he was found hiding in a Norfolk property with almost 90 cannabis plants. Julian Bellow, 28, was discovered by police at an address in Great Yarmouth where a total of 88 cannabis plants were found in one room, along with sophisticated growing equipment. Norwich Crown Court heard Bellow, who was said to be a gardener in the operation uncovered on June the 14th this year, had previously been sentenced to 18 months in prison at Cambridge Crown Court, after he admitted producing cannabis in 2020. Martin Ivory, prosecuting, said as well as the cannabis found in a ground floor room, there were three other rooms which contained growing equipment. Mr. Ivory said Bellow made no comment in interviews with police, although he accepts he was the gardener of the cannabis plants found by police at the property. Bellow, no fixed abode, appeared at court on Wednesday, September the 20th via video link from HMP Norwich and spoke through an interpreter, having previously admitted production of cannabis. Sentencing Bellow to 20 months in prison, Judge Andrew Shaw said, "You clearly did not learn your lesson." He said, despite being jailed previously for the same offence, Bellow had ended up being involved in the production of cannabis where 88 plants were recovered, but it was clearly capable of growing more. Judge Shaw said it was likely Bellow would be deported after his sentence, although that was a matter for the Home Office. Judge Durr, mitigating, said Bellow, who was born in Albania, was of no fixed abode at the time and should receive credit for his plea. He said the defendant's contention he was nothing more than a gardener fitted with the evidence in the case. Forfeiture and destruction of the plants and growing equipment was also ordered. And now a report of an attack. A woman has been injured in an attack in Gorleston. The assault happened in the early evening of Saturday, September the 9th, in Veronica Green. A man was reported to have punched and kicked a woman. Both parties were known to each other. A member of the public helped to stop the victim following the attack, and police are now attempting to find witnesses. Anyone with information has been asked to contact PC Matthew Robson at Gorleston Police Station on 101. And a further development in a report I vaguely remember reading out some years ago now. A body part has been found on a beach and it's been confirmed as belonging to a man who went missing nearly 2 years ago. Police have said that the body part found in Winterton is from missing man, Pavel Martiniak, who disappeared from Galston in 2021. The 21-year-old could not be traced despite extensive checks and searches. The part has been provisionally identified as belonging to Mr. Martiniak following forensic examination, pending formal coroner proceedings. The death is not believed to be suspicious, and police would not identify what part of the body was found. Mr. Martiniak, from Carroll Road in Galston, was last seen in the area at around 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November the 30th, 2021. He was reported missing by his family in the early hours of Wednesday, December the 1st. He was later seen by a witness in Victoria Road heading in the direction of the seafront. The Martiniak family and Norfolk Constabulary have issued a number of pleas since his disappearance. Posters were distributed widely in Great Yarmouth, Galston and Colchester, and officers were deployed as far as London to assist with possible sightings. In November 2022, Mr. Martiniak's father said, "It's still a very difficult time, getting worse by the day. This has been the most heartbreaking and challenging year of our lives. We're still unsure about Pavel's well-being, and we're very concerned he may be injured or unwell. We think about him and miss him every passing day." Mr. Martiniak was born in Poland and moved to the UK in 2004, studied at Notre Dame High School in Norwich and East Norfolk Sixth Form College. He later attended the University of Essex to study business, but decided to leave midway through his first year. He spent much of his time at home reading philosophy, attending St. Peter's Catholic Church in Galston, and was also a lifeguard during the summer holidays in Hemsby. And the next report is of a man who's got to have his movements tracked by GPS monitoring while he awaits trial for stalking a woman. Gary Nichols, 63, pleaded not guilty to coercive and controlling behaviour and stalking of the woman between April 2022 and December the 16th this year. Norwich Magistrates Court heard his actions had caused the woman to be in fear of violence from him. He was banned from entering the village of Martham, with the exclusion being enforced by a GPS tracking tag. Prosecutors said, despite a restraining order, the allegations had also included that he had repeatedly visited her home, made phone calls, banged on her doors and gone through her rubbish. District Judge David Wilson ruled the case was too serious to be heard by magistrates after an application to commit the case to Norwich Crown Court was unopposed by his defence solicitor, Annette Hall. Nichols, of Station Road in Rackheath, was made subject of a conditional bail until a hearing on October the 16th, including not to contact the woman or two neighbours who are witnesses. And a report of speeding checks. Police officers are increasing patrols across Norfolk this week amid a crackdown to help protect vulnerable road users. The Joint Roads and Armed Policing Team are conducting high-visibility roadside speeding checks until Sunday, September the 24th. They will be using both marked and unmarked vehicles to target reckless and speeding drivers. These patrols are part of a police support of two national campaigns, the Vulnerable Road Users Operation and National Eye Health Week campaign called Your Vision Matters. The Vulnerable Road Users Operation aims to raise the awareness of the added risks faced by pedestrians, cyclists, motorcyclists and horse riders on the roads. These groups account for a disproportionate number of deaths and serious injuries in collisions. Chief Inspector Jonathan Chapman, head of the Joint Norfolk and Suffolk Roads and Armed Policing Team, said, "We want all motorists to drive with care, to be on the lookout for vulnerable road users, and ensure you pass them at an appropriate speed, allowing sufficient time and space to do so. Pedestrians, cyclists and riders have as much right to be on the roads as anyone else. Officers across Norfolk will be on high alert for the fatal four offences of drink and drug driving, speeding, using a mobile phone while driving, and driving without wearing a seatbelt. Norfolk's Police and Crime Commissioner, Giles Orpen-Smailies, added, "We seem to see road deaths as a routine occurrence, as opposed to other fatalities such as knife crime. I would very much like society to be more concerned about this. We can only address the unnecessary loss of lives on our roads by educating people to drive safely in a manner that permits all road users a safe passage, and this is why it's one of the key priorities in my police, crime and community safety plan." And a report of a hotel being burnt down. However, this is a bug hotel called Buggingham Palace. It's been burnt down in a suspected arson attack. The shelter, built for insects as part of a community project on the grounds of the Sea Life Centre in Great Yarmouth, was destroyed in a blaze at around 6:45 p.m. on Monday, September the 18th. Norfolk Police said the incident is being treated as arson and our inquiries are ongoing. Nathan Barnett, General Manager of the Sea Life Great Yarmouth, said, "Both the team and I were a bit shocked to see this morning that Buggingham Hotel had been burnt down. It's a bit disappointing, really. It's just a senseless act of vandalism. It ruins everything for everybody else." He said that the CCTV of the incident shows six teenagers, three males and three females, some still in school uniform. One of the teenagers is seen taking out a lighter and setting fire to the Bug Hotel, then running off, he said. Mr. Barnett added that the fire could have been a lot worse, as the Bug Hotel was located close to the Sea Life Centre building. "A lot of time and effort had gone into this project, and it was about putting something back into the community and helping the local environment," he said. "We're going to rebuild it. We're not going to let this get us down. It will come back bigger, better and stronger." Mr. Barnett said the new centre will now put a call out to local businesses for donations of materials, including pallets and bedding, to build a new centre. Sea Life said it was difficult to say how many bugs had been living in the shelter, as it had only been up for 4 weeks, but they would have expected species such as woodlice, spiders, butterflies, ladybirds, earwigs, snails, worms and ants to have made a home there as more time passed. A Norfolk Police spokesman said, "Police were called to assist the fire service with a suspected arson at 6:53 on Monday on Marine Parade, Great Yarmouth. The fire was put out and no one was injured. Inquiries are ongoing." And another report of a fire, although this one was natural causes. Four fire crews were called to a house blaze which was started by a lightning strike during heavy thunderstorms. Emergency services attended the fire at 1 a.m. on Monday after reports of the blaze in Bellamy Drive in Bradwell. The fire was eventually extinguished almost 2 hours later at 2:44 a.m. by firefighters using main and hose reel jets. After the roof was struck by lightning during heavy thunderstorms near the coast, the building caught fire and flames were seen by people living nearby. An eyewitness reported a blast so loud that her house windows shivered at the time of the lightning impact. Crews from Acle, Great Yarmouth, Gorleston and the aerial ladder platform from Earlham were at the scene. Now a report on Great Yarmouth Council and its financial situations. Difficult decisions are needed to tackle Great Yarmouth Council's financial situation, the leader has said. The warning comes as the council seeks to balance the books amid a deficit of nearly £3 million, with critics describing the situation as dire. But efforts already underway to save money appear to be slipping, according to the latest budget report. At a scrutiny committee meeting this week, Council Leader Carl Smith said, "We have some really difficult decisions to make. Hopefully we can work together across the council to look at every aspect to see where we can save money and make those choices together." Trevor Wainwright, leader of the Labour Group, criticised the Conservative-led cabinet, saying, "It seems like some members have taken their eye off the ball. The situation is dire now, but there's a big deficit which looks like it will be worse next year. The council has been forced to dip into its reserves in order to cover a black hole of nearly £3 million in its general fund budget and housing stock revenue. There have also been losses of £182,000 due to the running costs of a number of facilities, such as Galston Splash Pad, events like the Easter Fair and the market, which has already cost £137,000 this last quarter, even before it's completed. Any plans to save money by selling off the Greyfriars Council building have been hit with delays, meaning the predicted savings have dropped by £58,000. Bernard Williamson, chairman of the committee, added, "My main concern is that there are things that look on paper like savings, but will they come into fruition?" Fears were also raised over the future, with Michael Gill worrying that the council would be unable to use big chunks of money from the reserves, which must be kept at a minimum of £3.5 million. Chief Finance Officer Karen Sly said the council will look at all the commitments to find where it was possible to reallocate earmarked reserves in order to maintain this fund if needed. And moving on to a housing and planning report. A bid to convert part of a former police station into flats has been refused. Michael Foti of Lindana Building Services Limited was seeking permission to convert the ground floor of the former police station in Caister on the junction of High Street and West Road into two flats. But planners at Great Yarmouth Borough Council said the loss of the station's main doorway would be harmful to the appearance of the building within the street scene. They also raised concerns about the lack of affordable housing, as permission has already been granted for 8 residential units on the site. Those earlier plans include 2 pairs of 4-bedroom houses and 1 pair of 3-bedroom houses. The plans also include the conversion and change of use of the main building to create 2 flats and 2 shops on the ground floor. As things stand, the houses have been built, and works to start the conversion of the upper floors of the building are underway. And the central main doorway is blocked up presently with concrete blocks.
No news from Vision Norfolk this week, apart from the fact that Desney and I were pleased to visit their Bradbury Centre in Norwich on Monday, which, although being for a meeting of Norfolk's talking newspaper groups, gave us a chance to view their facilities and get a better understanding of their operation. And the cake was good also. It is, however, the start of autumn, and so we're pleased to welcome the periodic message of advice from the Norfolk Fire Service.
Hello everybody, this is Greenwatch from Great Yarmouth Fire Station bringing you our autumn community safety messages on behalf of Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service. We have 3 key home safety messages to bring you this autumn. Firstly, chimney and open fire safety. If you have a wood burner or open fire, book in a chimney sweep to clear out the flue of dust from last year. Ensure the hearth surrounding your chimney is clean and clear of ornaments and logs. Make sure your logs are completely dry before burning them. Using damp logs leaves creosote in your chimney, and this increases your risk of chimney fires. Don't dry clothes directly in front of the fire, and don't leave a burning fire unattended. Secondly, electric heaters. If you use an electric heater, firstly ensure it is connected at the wall or on a flat extension socket. not a cube-shaped extension socket, as these aren't as safe. Keep the heater away from soft furnishings. Don't drape clothes over the heater, and don't leave your heater unattended. And finally, carbon monoxide alarms. Carbon monoxide is a colourless, odourless, tasteless gas that is sometimes emitted from gas appliances such as cookers and boilers, or from fireplaces. To reduce this risk, position a carbon monoxide alarm near your boiler and your gas or open fire. Ensure your home is well ventilated and service your appliances regularly. Empty your fires or stoves of ash regularly. Carbon monoxide poisoning is known as a silent killer. Symptoms include nausea and vomiting, headaches, dizziness, and loss of consciousness. If your carbon monoxide detector alarms and you are suffering from these symptoms, please call 999. If you're not experiencing these symptoms, contact the emergency gas line on 0800 111 999. Don't forget to test your smoke alarms every week for Test It Tuesday, and in the event of a fire, get out, stay out, call 999. For further advice or to request a home safety visit from Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service, call 0300 123 1448 or go on Norfolk Fire and Rescue's website.
Well, we hope that you find that useful. And due to the input from us and other talking newspapers, they're collaborating with both the police and Trading Standards Office, whose sage advice will be coming up during the next couple of weeks. OK, back to Andy, followed very closely by his namesake Andrew, chatting to David Tubby.
People could be forced to book slots to dump rubbish at Norfolk's tips under plans being drawn up by County Hall. Conservative-controlled Norfolk County Council is considering introducing the scheme as a way to save money by controlling numbers visiting recycling centres. However, critics have described the idea as a non-starter, which will discourage people from recycling and lead to a surge in fly tipping. The council may introduce the booking scheme to limit the estimated £1 million impact of the government's plans to abolish some of the fees councils, including Norfolk, charge for getting rid of household DIY waste. Charges for large amounts of DIY waste have been in place for more than two decades. But in 2018, the County Council removed a concession which allowed people to leave small amounts of waste for free. That meant people were charged to leave materials such as rubble, plasterboard, doors, fence panels, fitted units and bathroom suites. Charges per 80-litre sack or single item range from £3.50 to £12. But following public consultation last year, the government announced it would abolish fees for disposing of limited amounts and types of DIY waste at recycling centres. While the council has kept the fees in place, pending legislation changes, County Hall's officers said the government is not giving them any extra money to cover its increased costs, which they say could be between £500,000 and £1 million. Officers, in a report which will come before councillors, state booking systems for customers using recycling centres are widely used across the country and require customers to book an appointment prior to arriving at the site. The changes to DIY charging, expected to be introduced by government, may mean the potential role of a booking system for customers that use the recycling centre service has to be considered. Officers said that would allow the County Council to respond to the government's changes in a way that is capable of managing those requirements and limiting their financial impact. Asked if the booking system would be for all trips to tips or only for disposal of DIY waste, a council spokeswoman said, "At this stage, it is too early to say. This is referenced as an intervention that may be required in the future and would have to be fully scoped out." Suffolk County Council already operates a booking system for all tip trips, but Brian Watkins, leader of the Liberal Democrat group at the council, said he was worried about the implications of doing that in Norfolk. He said, councils have been forced onto the back foot with the government's proposed changes to DIY charging. But there are dangers with introducing a booking system for customers. Not everyone will comply with such a request, and my fear is that it could lead to an unwarranted increase in fly tipping around the country. We should be making access easier and more efficient, not adding another layer of bureaucracy and frustration, which could deter people from disposing of their recycled waste in a proper manner. Labour County Councillor Terry Jeremy said, "A booking system is a non-starter. It would deter people from recycling and would increase fly tipping. The reason the government has for scrapping the DIY waste charges is to make it easier for people to recycle, but this would just make it harder." Green County Councillor Jamie Osborne said, "Introducing even more limits on when people can use the tip will just create more barriers for people who want to get rid of waste responsibly. I frequently have people say to me that they can't get to the tip now it's been moved out of the city and it's too expensive to take items there." The issue will be discussed at a meeting of the authorities' scrutiny committee. And a short item about health. People wanting to check their heart health are being invited to a free roadshow in Great Yarmouth. The event, to mark World Heart Day, takes place in the Marina Centre on Marina Parade on Friday, September 29th from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Visitors will have the opportunity to have their blood pressure, heart rhythm and weight checked by East Coast Community Healthcare's cardiac rehabilitation team. Organisations including Heart to Heart, Smoke Free Norfolk, Active Now, Sports Club 88 and Freedom Leisure will have stands, as well as the Community Healthcare's physiotherapy service. Free car parking is available if you register your vehicle at reception on arrival. And now an item of one of our tourist attractions. Abysmal trade has forced one of Norfolk's best-loved tourist attractions to close its doors during weekdays. Joyland Children's Fun Park on Marine Parade in Great Yarmouth announced on its Facebook page that it will be closing during the week from this point onwards. The post, published on Friday, September the 15th, says the park tried opening every day during September, but there was not enough trade. On Monday, September the 18th, owner Michael Cole said it was no longer economically viable to keep the business open from Friday to Monday. He said that wages have increased and electricity bills have almost doubled. "It was a hard decision to make. Summer trade has been okay. As soon as the schools broke up for holidays, the weather turned quite wet for 2 weeks. We didn't have a bumper summer, but it wasn't a disaster. It's been average," he said. Joyland will continue to open at weekends from 11 a.m, weather permitting, until the end of October. The park will also be open from October the 23rd to the 29th for the half-term holiday. It then closes for the winter and reopens again in mid to late March next year for the summer season. The neighbouring American Diner will remain open during weekdays. Mr. Cole also spoke about the evening economy along Yarmouth's seafront. "The nighttime trade is getting worse and worse. It's nearly non-existent," he said. "The trend has been there for the last 10 years. The only night worth keeping the park open is Wednesday night for the fireworks, but that could be advertised better. A lot of holidaymakers coming to Yarmouth don't know about the fireworks night. Yarmouth is a tripper town. People come for the day and leave. Then the transport infrastructure from the holiday parks to the seafront isn't brilliant. And there's not much evening entertainment to encourage people to come back," he added. And the next story is a bit of a row over school uniforms. Furious parents have pulled their 12-year-old girl out of school in a row over an ear stud. TMA Brown, who lives in Filby, landed in trouble at Caister Academy last week after she was spotted sporting the stud, even though her form teacher had the same kind of piercing. The school has defended its actions, but TMA's dad, Nigel Brown, said the situation was an absolute joke and kept his daughter home from school on Wednesday, September the 20th, planning not to send her back to class. Mr. Brown said, "We're not going to tolerate this anymore. We're not going to have her mental well-being affected by this anymore." TMA said she'd been wearing the stud at school for about a week before anybody noticed. She said she was at assembly last week when the head of year saw the stud and told the form teacher, with the same piercing, to take her to reflection. "I feel really upset because it's one rule for us and another rule for the teachers," TMA said. "We should all be treated the same." Caister Academy's uniform policy said students may wear up to one pair of small ear studs or sleepers, one per earlobe. Mr. Brown, 57, a health and safety coach, said, "We're sick and tired of the way our daughter is being treated. Every day she's being taken out of lessons. Our daughter is dreading going to school now, every day. This piercing poses no health and safety concerns or risks to any other student at the school, yet head of the year claims this is a violation of the school's uniform and behaviour policy, despite my daughter always wearing the proper uniform and having no prior behavioural issues at the school." Last Thursday, the parents had a meeting with the year head and asked why TMA's form teacher has exactly the same piercing and yet this was acceptable. Mr. Brown said they were told because he's a teacher and policies only apply to students. "When it comes to hypocritical, they're at the pinnacle of it," he said. The Browns also pointed out that members of the staff walk round in short dresses and skirts, hanging earrings, high heels and lots of makeup. Yet other parents have complained of their daughter's skirts being measured to ensure they comply with the school uniform policy. "That is very disturbing, as we do not live in North Korea, to my knowledge," Mr. Brown said. At last week's meeting, it was agreed that TMA May could attend lessons if she wore her hair over the piercing, Mr. Brown said. But on Monday, September the 18th, she was sent into isolation again. A school spokesperson said, "At Caister Academy, we are committed to working collaboratively with students and their parents so that all students fulfil their potential in a safe and caring learning environment. And we are proud of the high standards Caister students achieve. Our expectations for behaviour and uniform are shared with parents each year and are available on our website. There have been no recent changes to our guidance for jewellery. Staff adhere to our professional dress code at all times in work. When any student is placed in reflection, outside of their usual classroom, their learning is fully supported by a dedicated member of staff." Mr. Brown said, "It's an absolute joke. There's nothing wrong with her behaviour." He said it was essential to question and challenge policies that seem arbitrary and hypocritical. TMA said she had not received much support while in reflection. "I hope to get back to class because this is going to affect all of my grades," she said. "I've always really liked maths and stuff." And in news of a walk. An Extinction Rebellion spokesman is planning to walk the Norfolk coast wearing a snorkel and goggles in an effort to raise awareness of rising sea levels. Dr. Charlie Gardner, who lives in Ashenwick in West Norfolk, wants to take 15 days to cover a route of 180 miles from Cambridge to King's Lynn, around the North Norfolk coast to Great Yarmouth, and then across to Norwich. Dr. Gardner, who's an associate senior lecturer at the University of Kent, said, "Our homes and many of the places we love are threatened by climate change. yet the government is ignoring the urgent warnings of the global scientific community. We know what needs to be done to keep us safe. We need to stop burning fossil fuels. Yet the government is still allowing new oil and gas exploration in the North Sea, opening new coal mines, and holding us back from moving on to a better, safer way of doing things. Dr. Gardner said he hoped his walk would raise awareness of rising sea levels among people living in vulnerable areas and encourage them to take action themselves to help save their homes and other much-loved places. He plans to undertake the walk between September the 24th and October the 8th. Places he wants to stop along the way include Wells Next to the Sea on September the 30th, Overstrand on October the 2nd, and Great Yarmouth on October the 4th. Dr. Gardner added, "I feel like we've been abandoned by the people who are in charge of keeping us safe, but there's lots we can all do in our own lives to turn the situation around. That starts by recognising the threat and talking about it. So I hope my walk will help start a few conversations." And another walking story. A huge 32-metre-long steel walkway, in other words a pedestrian bridge, was transported through Norfolk and Suffolk on Tuesday afternoon, with police escorting the 44-tonne load to its final destination. And drivers were warned of possible delays throughout Norfolk and Suffolk as the walkway was driven along the A47. And it eventually arrived at its destination of Station Square in Lowestoft during the afternoon. Footage shared by the Lowestoft Central project of the arrival of the abnormal load showed traffic coming to a halt as the vehicle negotiated tight bends at slow speed with the 32-metre-long walkway aboard. The police convoy had left Besomer Way on Great Yarmouth's Holfrey's Industrial Estate at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, as it was transported via William Adams Way to the A47. And I'll spare you the details of its route to Lowestoft.
Well, joining me once again is David Tubby, our local historian. David, welcome back to Grapevine. Now, this week's subject is, and I think I can say, a world-famous sporting venue right in the centre of Great Yarmouth, the Wellesley Recreation Ground. David, you've written a book on the history of Yarmouth Town Football Club, and of course the iconic main stand features heavily in this. Is it true to say that's the oldest football stand in the world?
It's thought to be. I always say thought to be because you never know whether another one will be found in some obscure part of the world.
Sure.
But so I always say it's thought to be the oldest. Start certainly after the Bradford fires, a lot of football stands were inadequate.
Was that 1985?
Yeah. A lot of football stands were pulled down. Yarmouth's remained. It's wooden at the, in the upper part and brick at the bottom. Built in 1892.
So was that built when the ground was first there?
The ground was opened in 1880.
Yeah.
1888, sorry.
Originally as a football ground?
No. Originally as a recreation ground, because there were a number of sports that took place in Yarmouth, mainly on the dunes, the Eames.
Yeah.
There was a golf course, they played football, they played cricket, but it was on levelled off land, it was pretty rough. There was net spins laid out to dry that got in the way. It was pretty chaotic.
So down the area like where the Pleasure Beach and that would be?
Yeah, they would have done all the way along from probably the harbour's mouth where the old race course was, all the way through to the golf course, which was originally on North Dean's Road, the golf course started. So
there was a need.
There was a need, ground, basically. And in 1888, the council decided to do a new recreation ground. And they actually went away and visited other tracks, because the original thought was, and the original two sports, in fact, were athletics and cycling.
Cycling?
Yeah, they had a cinder cycle track.
Yeah.
And inside that was a grass athletics track.
Yeah.
And they were the two first sports that took place on the opening day in 1888.
Was there a Yarmouth Town Football Club in those days?
No, Yarmouth Town didn't form until 1897.
Right.
And then they didn't start on the Wellesley, they started on the Beaconsfield.
Yeah.
They didn't go to the Wellesley till about the 1901 season. They were a bit slow getting there, although other football clubs had played there. In the early days, there was, apart from the athletics and the cycling, there was cricket.
Yeah.
There was football. There was, started off with a concrete tennis court, and eventually became grass ones as well.
Yeah.
And eventually, before the First World War, a bowling green. And a croquet green.
And a croquet green as well.
How they crammed that lot in.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. Never know.
Never know.
It takes, it's hard to envisage.
Yeah. Now, that's seen a few famous matches on there. The biggest, I believe, was against Crystal Palace. Was it in 53?
53, yeah, when they won 1-0.
What was the crowd? Do you know?
8,944. And the takings were £900, which is staggering. If you think 1953, that would have probably bought four houses,
yeah,
at least.
Incredible.
£900 worth of takings. But the crowd was accommodated by putting fish boxes in tiers,
yeah,
up either end of the, behind the goals.
Yeah.
Behind the goals, either end. And people stood so they could see that they, these fish boxes were tiered.
Yeah.
Health and safety was non-existent.
Exactly.
And it must have been quite precarious to be on the top row.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to try and envisage 8,000 people now in the Wellesley, yeah, incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it was the first round of the FA Cup proper.
Yeah.
Yarmouth had been there the previous year.
Really?
They played Wrexham and lost 2-1.
But that's never kind of gone down in folklore as much as
no,
this one has.
No, the Crystal Palace, because we won, and
yeah,
Derek Rackham scored that famous early goal.
I thought that's what it was. I thought it was Mr. Rackham, bless him.
Yeah, he used to play for Norwich.
Yeah.
And there was Jack Bradley, who used to play for league as well, in the
oh,
league
yeah,
as well.
Jack Bradley, who went on to keep the Jolly Farmers
at Jolly Farmers at Ormsby, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was my next question. I said there's a few famous players that graced that turf. Yourself, I think, Yarmouth Boys?
Only once.
Okay.
Yarmouth Boys and the English School Shield.
Well,
against Chelmsford.
A few more names trip off the tongue at all?
Yeah. Well, my most famous one, because he wasn't a childhood idol of mine, was Johnny Haynes.
Really? Do you remember the great Johnny Haynes played there?
Yarmouth used to play for a cup called the Beaver Cup. It was presented in the 1890s by a Yarmouth businessman, Alfred Beaver. And it was a charity cup, and the proceeds used to go to the hospitals.
Yeah.
And in the 50s, there was a run of league teams that played Yarmouth for the cup at the end of the season, or beginning of the season.
Was that as a warm-up matches,
well,
season matches for them?
Two of them. They played Walsall and Plymouth on their return from Norwich. Walsall and Plymouth,
yeah,
in 2 years running,
yeah,
had played Norwich at Carrow Road on the
yeah,
Saturday.
Yeah.
Played Yarmouth on the Monday before going home.
Goodness me.
I mean, that wouldn't happen today,
certainly
would it?
Certainly wouldn't.
And in 19, I think it was 53 again, in the April, they played Second Division Fulham.
Yeah.
And inside right, this was Beef. In the early days of his career,
yeah,
was the early England captain, Johnny Haynes.
Johnny Haynes, the man who used to practice with a tennis ball.
Yeah, and I used to idolise when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Because he was always renowned for the through pass that he used to put.
Yeah, yeah.
But behind the fullback.
Now, and this is a bit contentious, the ground share with Galston. Locally, it's a bit like the Berlin Wall coming down, or decimalisation, but people said it'd never happen. what's the immediate future? Do we know?
I haven't heard any rumours recently. There have been talks.
Yeah.
They didn't materialise into anything at the end of last season, so I understand. Personally, as an old Yarmouth supporter, I hope it doesn't happen.
No.
I suppose if it happened, it should have happened, 50 years ago?
So that the
It should have happened after the Second World War.
Yeah.
And they should have developed a new ground at Southtown Common. So it was midway between the two.
Between the two, yeah. We maybe could have
inhabitants.
Been a King's Lynn or something like that.
Yeah.
A little higher up the pyramid.
I think Goulson supporters will struggle to come over to the Wellesley.
Yeah.
I don't think their crowds are very big. In fact, in many ways, it was easier for them to get to Lowestoft.
Right.
Because it was only down the A12.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
And now they have to get through all the traffic that builds up on the bypass to get to the Wellesley.
But Yarmouth Town itself appear to be in good hands, a good sab.
Good hands, but they've never had a benefactor like Goulson have.
No.
So they've always struggled.
Yeah.
And I think they always will, because these days in football, money talks.
Of course.
And if you can't find someone to finance you, you can struggle.
Yeah.
And players will go to the highest bidder.
Yeah.
But, the Wellesley is still there. It's still nostalgic.
Did the stadium get any grants now to for the upkeep at all?
They did have some money last year, and there's a new 3G area which has been developed.
Yeah.
The old bowls and tennis pavilion has been done up with that money,
mm-hmm.
because I got that listed at the same time as grandstand and the little gatehouse.
Yeah.
Nearly 20 years ago now. So they had to do something with it. They couldn't let it fall down.
No.
So that little tennis pavilion's now been developed into, I believe, changing rooms for the 3G area.
But the changing rooms are still below the grandstand as they always were, yeah?
Yeah, and still probably as shabby as they always were.
Yes, yeah, I would say. But it's still an iconic part of the town, isn't it? So it's lovely to see it still there.
And yeah, I mean, we do get what we call ground hoppers in the football community. They go from ground to ground to record they've been somewhere.
Right.
And they always want to pick up Yarmouth.
That's
because
good.
Of the grandstand.
Yeah, oh, that's always good, isn't it? That it's attracting a sort of a wider audience as well.
Yeah.
So who knows, out there, we might have a Hollywood star decide he'll come and take it over.
who knows? It'd be nice, wouldn't it?
David, that's wonderful. Thanks again for a great insight on another local iconic building. We'll be right back.
Well, it just had to be done. After that chat about the Wellesley Grandstand, both the first and the final theme from the 40-year history of the famous BBC sports programme of the same name. And I mean Grandstand, not Wellesley. Right, it's time to get you completely up to date with the rest of this week's local news.
Now an animal story. Perhaps a sad one. A horse sanctuary has bid a fond farewell to one of its oldest and much-loved adoption stars after a long illness. Staff at Red Wings Horse Sanctuary announced on Monday that Muffin the Mule had died after 36 years at the rescue. Muffin was rescued as a foal from slaughter in 1987 with his mother, a pony called Doris, and homed at Red Wings Caldecott near Great Yarmouth. Sadly, Doris died shortly after their arrival due to a stomach ulcer, and with Red Wings' support, Muffin became one of the charity's most well-known animals. Lynn Kutris, Red Wings' chief executive, said, "It's left a huge hole in the hearts of all the staff here at Red Wings, and we know our supporters will feel that too. Some families sponsored him for generations, and we were delighted by Muffin's friendly nature and mischievous ways for more than three decades. As, of course, there were staff who cared for him day in and day out. We all loved him dearly." In his latter years, Muffin was diagnosed with Cushing's disease, which made him prone to a hoof condition called laminitis. Red Wings retired him from the adoption scheme in 2017 so he could enjoy a quieter life. And after health complications, the rescue centre had to take the difficult decision to put him down. Laura Starkey, Red Wings Caldecott Equine Centre manager, added, "Muffin was one in a million, such a patient, calm boy. He loved his feed and would often stand waiting by his bowl 30 minutes before time, with a face that said, 'What's been keeping you?' He took life at his own pace, and you certainly couldn't rush him. He has been here since the beginning of Red Wings Caldecott, and we'll miss him terribly." And a lifeboat story, and a good one. A new lifeboat, named after the late couple whose will funded its construction, is getting ready to sail in Norfolk. On Saturday, September the 23rd, Great Yarmouth and Galston's RNLI station will welcome the arrival of the organisation's first ever legacy boat. The name of the vessel, a Shannon Class RNLB 1344, is George and Francis Phelon. The construction of the lifeboat was fully funded by a gift in the will of Francis Phelon, who asked that the vessel be named after herself and her late husband. Currently, five crew members of the Great Yarmouth and Galston lifeboat station are at the RNLI headquarters in Poole, where they're training and preparing to make the passage from there to Great Yarmouth and Galston. At 1:20 p.m, the boat will arrive at Galston Pier, escorted by lifeboats from nearby stations, including the all-weather boat Samarabita and the inshore lifecraft John Rowntree. The vessels will then complete a display before heading into Galston Harbour. Once the lifeboats are moored up, the station will be open to the public to walk around and take a look at the legacy lifeboat. The crew is led by coxswain Andy Mason and second coxswain and station mechanic Rod Lewis, who together have more than 86 years of lifeboat experience. Events will begin at 10 a.m. with the opening of the RNLI shop in Galston. At 1:20, the new lifeboat will arrive, followed by a display. The lifeboat will then cross the pierheads into Galston Harbour at 1:44. The RNLI station will then open to the public at 2:30. Mr. Wells said, "After many hours of intensive training, we're finally getting together and looking forward to bringing our lifeboat home this Saturday." And the next story concerns goodie bags, free ones. A shop in the Broads is celebrating its 60th birthday by handing out free goodie bags to 200 customers. Latham's of Potter Heigham is hosting a range of activities over the weekend of September 23rd and 24th, and on each day it will give freebies to its first 100 customers. The bags will contain Latham's special edition bottle openers, trolley token and pens, a homegrown plant from one of QD's nurseries, as well as a variety of everyday products. The shop, a Norfolk institution famous for its fishing tackle and supplies, was opened by Ken Latham in 1963. When he retired in 1989, Latham's joined the Norfolk Discount Group, QD. The shop will mark 6 decades in business with a host of activities, including free vintage open top bus tours, competitions and giveaways, food stalls, face painting, a toy tombola and music. Nick Rubin, CEO of the QD Group, said, "Latham's has been a linchpin in Potter Heigham for 60 years, and we're delighted to have played our part in keeping this Norfolk institution running successfully during this time. The store is very dear to us, and even today we have strong connections to its founder. Anne Sharman, our head of supply chain at QD, is actually the daughter of Norman Sharman, who sold Ken the land on which Latham's is built. Ken even gave Anne's mum a lift to hospital when she was in labour with her," Mr. Rubin said. John Goldie, store manager at Latham, said, "We're very much looking forward to hosting this 60th birthday event, which will give Latham's customers, new and old, the opportunity to celebrate with us and enjoy the history behind this jewel of the Norfolk Broads. It looks set to be an action-packed weekend with something for everyone to enjoy. Do come along and enjoy the fun." I now have a literary story. I don't say that very often. A grieving father is publishing a children's book inspired by the stories he used to tell his late son. Tim Hills from Great Yarmouth came up with the tale Why Do Crabs Walk Sideways more than 20 years ago when his son Carl was a child. Mr. Hills said, "Carl's always used to tell me to send the stories out and try and get them published, but I never did." Last year, Carl, who lived with his father in Cobham, died of an embolism related to COVID. He was 28 years old. He had been complaining about one of his legs aching, and he went to the doctors to get it checked, Mr. Hills said. They arranged for him to have a blood test, but Carl caught COVID, so he couldn't get the blood test. He said that if his son had taken the blood test, the embolism might have been discovered. After his son's death, Mr. Hills was clearing out the spare room in their house when he found one of those old bedtime stories, which he'd typed up. "I thought, I owe it to Carl to at least try to get it published, so this is really for him." The book will be published on October the 13th under the name Timmy Hilly. It's a picture book which tells the story of a colony of crabs that's being terrorised by a seagull named Simon. Mr. Hills, who now lives in Lowestoft and works at the James Paget Hospital, started making up children's stories with Carl when he was around 6 years old. "I would borrow books from the library, but I'd start elaborating on them, exaggerating some of the characters. Then I started writing a few just for him. When the book is published, it will be tinged with sadness because Carl is not there to see it," he said. A boating story. Thousands of people flocked to the Broads on Saturday night, the 16th September, to see Norfolk's network of waterways in a new light. The Ludham Illuminated Boat Parade featured 20 boats, and they all had a theme, ranging from Under the Sea to Alice in Wonderland. The procession then set off from Womack Staithe in Ludham at 6:45 to its destination at Potter Heigham Bridge, with live music and refreshments at both locations. After delighting onlookers in Potter Heigham, the boats then paraded back to Ludham. Bill Grist, one of the organisers, said, "It was a brilliant night with huge crowds at Potterheim and Ludham. We estimate 5,000 people watched the events, lining the riverbanks from Ludham to Potterheim. We're blown away by the response, and we're already planning more parking and more entertainment for next year. We hope this will become a fixture in the calendar, which promotes the very best of the Broads." The event is organised by and raises money for the Friends of St Catherine's, Ludham. And a story of a lady who sounds like she's had a good life. Vida Haylett was 96 years old when her car failed its MOT. If it wasn't for that, the Great Yarmouth woman, who was the town's first female taxi driver, would still be driving. During the Second World War, she was often seen whisking passengers to weddings, funerals and other social events. But on Wednesday, September the 20th, it was her daughter Jenny who drove the Centurion to the Methodist Church Hall in Galston, where a surprise party had been arranged. Vida thought she was attending a meeting of the Great Yarmouth and Galston Memory Club, where her daughter plays music. Little did she know that more than 30 members of her extended family were hiding there, waiting for her. And when Jenny started playing the Happy Birthday song, the curtains were pulled back to reveal the surprise guests. Vida was born in one of Great Yarmouth Rows in 1923 and grew up with two brothers and a little sister. After leaving the hospital school, she worked alongside her father at his car garage. She was 16 when war broke out in 1939, by which time her father was running Crane's Taxis and the Coachmaker's Arms in the marketplace. Vida was the first woman to have a taxi licence during the war. As well as the car, she drove a unique Daimler automobile. The interior had been turned into a canteen, and when bombs dropped on Yarmouth, she would drive the car to the marketplace and make tea and coffee for the men and women involved in the rescue attempts. One morning, she rescued a man from rubble after a bomb had fallen and took him to hospital in the taxi. After the war, she married Johnny Haylett and carried on driving her cab. Her daughter said, "She still cooks for herself, she is still independent, and she misses driving." Good on you, Vida. And my last news report is by way of a breaking news. It came in very late. An investigation is underway into a mystery contract for a major market revamp project. The leader of the Great Yarmouth Borough Council has said it cannot provide the full details of the inquiry due to it relating to confidential material. But a councillor has revealed it involves an issue with a contract for the multi-million pound covered market development. Members of the local authority were reviewing the latest report on the scheme during a scrutiny committee meeting. Councillor Michael Gill, who was frustrated by the positive portrayal of its progress, said, "This report makes it look absolutely perfect. I can't believe this in view of the investigation into the contract. We have never had a report to this council on who never signed the contract, who was legally responsible for the contract. I won't say who was to blame, maybe it just slipped their mind, but we still haven't had anything on this yet. It is understood that a monitoring officer is investigating the matter, which is related to the funding of the first phase of the covered market." Leader of the council, Carl Smith, said, "There's currently an investigation going on to do with commercially sensitive information which won't be released into the public domain. We just need to get to the bottom of it." The £4.7 million market revamp has been founded by the council itself and £3.5 million from the government's Future High Street Fund. In 2018, it was reported that the council missed out on a bid for £1.5 million of government funding. The project has been hit by delays over the course of the last 2 years due to supply chain issues and other factors. Some traders have now moved into the stores, but work continues on the site and the final completion date is unknown.
That's it for this week's recording, which is copyright 2023 of the Great Yarmouth District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. If you need to contact us, you can do so via our website at grapevinegy.org or telephone us on 07947 946 493, where you can access our regularly checked answering service. Next week, your newsreader will be Desney, so we look forward to welcoming you then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all at Grapevine, stay safe and well, and bye for now.